Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, and welcome to another essential episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. On today's podcast, we have another phone interview with Will Schutz from City Lit Theaters, Holmes and Watson. Also, Chicago critic Tom Williams gives us a couple of more audio reviews. And of course, as always, I will be bringing you Chicago's theater news. So buckle up, sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, hello, and hello. Welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, giving you the theater news for May 8th, 2006. The Joseph Jefferson Awards Committee has announced 112 nominations in 24 categories for Chicago's non-equity theatrical productions, which opened from the season of April 1st through March 31st. The Jeff Committee, as they're called, judged 129 opening night productions offered by over 60 non-equity producing organizations, and out of those Jeff citations come the Jeff Citation nominations. The biggest news of the announcement was that real-life husband and wife team Bill and Donna McGow have both received nominations as principal actors for their portrayals as husband and wife in Death of a Salesman. To find out who the recipients were for the 2005-2006 Citations Awards, you will have to go to the ceremony being held on June 5th at Park West in Chicago. Also, don't forget to check out the full list of 2005-2006 citations at TalkTheaterInChicago.com's Theater News section. The LaSalle Bank Theater reopening celebration begins on May 23rd. Following a multi-million dollar restoration and renovation, the LaSalle Bank Theater is ready to entertain Chicago for another 100 years. The century-old venue, gloriously restored and newly renamed the LaSalle Bank Theater, will now showcase previously hidden treasures, all uncovered during the restoration. The theater originally opened on New Year's Day back in 1906 as the Majestic Theater. It was renamed as the Schubert Theater back in 1945 and is now proud to wear its new moniker. The lighting of the marquee ceremony will take place on Tuesday, May 23rd at 8:30 at night. Gather around for a chance to see the lights illuminate for the first time ever with a special guest flipping the switch. Followed by that on Wednesday, May 24th, will be the inaugural performance of An Evening with Michael Crawford. And then the inaugural Broadway production will be Valerie Harper in Golda's Balcony. The Side Project is finally set to open their new space. After an unexpected permit process that put the January move into their new theater on hold, the Side Project has announced that it has completed the gamut of reviews and inspections needed to finally open their new location. And lucky for them, since Sean Graney has been rehearsing his latest play, Porno, for the past 4 weeks, his load-in is scheduled for May 6th, and since everything cleared up in time, the Side Project will be presenting the world premiere play as its first in their new theater. The Sean Graney-directed Porno will run through June 11th. Don't miss it. The First Folio Shakespeare Festival has announced its first subscription series. To open the season will be The Tempest, of course, by William Shakespeare. Following that will be The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story, adapted for the stage by David Rice and Alison Vesely. Then comes Angel Street, parentheses Gaslight, by Patrick Hamilton. Also, First Folio will be presenting Chicago's own Babes with Blades in their newest production, When Fairy Tales Attack. Do not miss that. Talk Theater in Chicago would like to thank two productions for excellent runs here in Chicago. Bark, which enjoyed a strong, respectable run at the Chicago Center for the Performing Arts, closed, unfortunately, last Sunday. And also, You're in Town at the Mercury Theater will be closing as well. These were strong shows with strong runs. Hopefully, you got to see them. Well, thank you for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Don't forget, you can check out the full list of Jeff Award Citation nominees at talktheaterinchicago.com. Till we meet next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here's my review of Holmes and Watson. Holmes and Watson, A Scandal in Bohemia and The Final Problem. At City Lit Theater. City Lit returns to their mission with the effective Holmes and Watson 1X. City Lit Theater, the jewel of Edgewater, specializes in literature theater, including stage adaptions of literary material. They return to that mission with a wonderful adaptation by director Terry McCabe of two of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's short stories, A Scandal in Bohemia, the first of a series of 56 short stories, and The Final Problem, the intended last of the Holmes short stories, even though 10 years later Doyle returned doing more Holmes stories. These Sherlock Holmes stories are narrated by Dr. Watson. These two one-acts are reimagined as psychological dramas that, except for a cameo by Megan Principe as Irene Adler, are really two-handers with Don Bender as Holmes and Will Schutz as Dr. Watson. Three things stand out in this marvelously engrossing show. One, how talented an actor Will Schutz truly is. He is equally adept with comedy and intense emotional roles and often moves from one character to another with a flick of an eye. He is a master craftsman of dialect, articulate, easily comfortable with fast-talking, descriptive language utilizing Irish, Cockney, or High English, Scottish, even German Bohemian accents. His eyes are almost popping out as he deftly conveys either the angst or the depths of humor in a scene. His Dr. Watson is a masterclass on acting and enunciation. Schutz often gets lost in the crowded ensemble work that he performs in, but in this two-hander, his craft illuminates the play as he delivers many of the key moments. The second thing you'll notice about this show is Don Bender and how smoothly he conveys Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, from the witty, erudite detective who warns Watson, "You see, but not observe," to the vulnerable, frightened, crime-fighting, obsessed with bringing down Professor Moriarty. Bender is a major talent at home with his characters. The third thing, or last thing, is Terry McCabe's brisk treatment of Holmes and Watson is an excellent primer to introduce new audiences to the marvels of Arthur Conan Doyle's writing, as well as offering his core audience a concise evening of strong acting, delivering worthy classic literature. Hopefully, McCabe has more of these Holmes and Watson stories in the hopper. Let's hope. In the first one, A Scandal in Bohemia, Holmes matches wits with Miss Adler, an opera singer and adventuress who haunts Holmes as the woman. Actually, Schutz's amazing depiction of the Bohemian king steals this act. In the second one act, The Final Problem, is Don Bender's act as he lands Holmes' fear and frustration with bringing down arch-criminal Professor Moriarty to justice. This textually accurate adaptation offers a fresh look into the personal relationships between the detective and the doctor. Did Holmes really die? You be the judge. Kudos to City Lit Theater for offering us such a polished work. Once you see this fine show, you'll go to the bookstore for more Arthur Conan Doyle stories. You're liable to see Will Schutz and Don Bender's photo on the dust jacket. My rating for this show? Recommended. It is Holmes and Watson at City Lit Theater Company in the Edgewater Presbyterian Church at 1020 West Bryn Mawr Avenue in Chicago. Tickets are $25. The show schedule is Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 3. The running time is 1 hour, 40 minutes with intermission. The show runs through June 4th, 2006. For more information, call 773-293-3682. That's 773-293-3682. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. And remember, go see a play this week. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here's my review of Oklahoma. Oklahoma. Music by Richard Rodgers, book and lyrics by Oscar Hammerstein II, based on the play Green Grow the Lilacs by Lynn Riggs. Oklahoma is number 5 on my all-time list of musicals. It opened in 1943 on Broadway, lasted over 5 years, an unheard-of run of 2,248 performances, toured the U.S. for 10 years, playing to over 250 cities, and attracting audiences in excess of 10 million. Critically acclaimed as the first musical play, where all the songs came out of character, furthered the plot, where music, lyrics, and book combined with dance to tell the story. Oklahoma was the first Broadway musical to incorporate ballet as a storytelling device with the famous Dream Ballet Act 1 ending number. In short, Oklahoma changed how Broadway did musicals, making it a landmark show where song and dance became key elements in the storytelling. All subsequent shows followed Oklahoma's model. Oklahoma was the first collaboration for Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein II, who went on to reshape Broadway with landmark shows such as Carousel, South Pacific, King and I, State Fair, and The Sound of Music. Stephen Sondheim lovingly referred to Oklahoma as Oscar's Picnic. Oklahoma contains one of the finest and most memorable scores ever written for the stage, and the creative genius of Rodgers and Hammerstein instantly becomes apparent within the first few bars of Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. No one is better at doing these classics than director William Polinsky. His long background at Candlelight Dinner Playhouse gives him a feel for preserving these great shows exactly as they were meant to be produced. He understands that audiences want to appreciate the original magic of these works. No reinterpretation here, thank God. With Oklahoma, Polinsky has cast this show from Chicago's A-list talent. Polinsky has two amazing leads to anchor the show. The boyishly charming and golden voice Zach Ford as Curly and Corey Goodrich, filled with charm and excellent singing skills as Laurie. Amy Silvestri's Aunt Eller, Alan Ball's Ollie Hocken, and Bobby Bagley's Annie each contribute excellent work to this ensemble piece. Richard Strimer's Will Parker is the lovable cowboy determined to marry Ado Annie if she can just learn to say no to men. Strimer anchors the terrific dances with his rousing Kansas City. Choreographer Stacy Flasher's fabulously creative, exhilarating routines add much to the texture of the show. She pays homage to Agnes DeMille's choreography while adding some clever small twists to make Oklahoma a pure dance show of the highest caliber. It is rare that a production of Oklahoma has such marvelous spellbounding final act number as the Dream Ballet. The integration of rich lighting by Shelley Strasser Holland with vivid costuming by Janice Pytel with Stacy Flasher's wonderful ballet moves makes this Dream Ballet a stirring and quite artistic endeavor. Flasher is a talented choreographer able to recreate original work while adding polished moves to enhance the established routines. She is in award territory here. She makes Oklahoma into a marvelously pleasant dance show. Richard Rodgers' score sounded fine with Chris Stellbaum's orchestration. The voices are strong and clear, from Zach Ford's charming Oh, What a Beautiful Morning and the Surrey with the Fringe on Top, immediately wins us over. Bobby Bagley's funny, "I'm Just a Girl Who Can't Say No," is a classic character-rich song full of honesty. The haunting romantic duet, "People Will Say We're in Love," gets Ford and Goodrich easily to hit their high notes. Larry Adams as the villain Judd Fry hits the lower register deftly with Zach Ford in the satirical "Poor Judd Is Dead" duet. Adams lands his angst completely with "Lonely Room." The girls are dainty in the "Out of My Dreams," which sets up the fabulous act-ending Dream Ballet, which features Matthew Cooley and Courtney Hischke. "The Farmer and the Cowman" is a bouncy barn dance ensemble piece that moves to a toe-tapping rhythm. Annie and Will Parker, which is Richard Strymer and Bagley, reach agreement with "All or Nothing." Laurie and Curly finally get married and celebrate the nuptial with the rousing anthem "Oklahoma," still one of the finest show tunes ever. The Theater at the Center in Munster, Indiana should be proud of this energetic, finely crafted mounting of a truly great musical. Take a ride to see this gem and bring someone who has never seen this landmark show with you. It just may get them to appreciate the Broadway musical art form. Kudos to this worthy show. My rating for the show, highly recommended. It's "Oklahoma" at the Theater at the Center, 1040 Ridge Road in Munster, Indiana. Tickets are $35. The schedule for the show is Wednesdays and Thursdays at 2 p.m., Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 8, and Sundays at 2:30 and 7. The running time is 2 hours and 45 minutes with intermission. It runs through June 4th. For more information, call 800-511-1552. That's 800-511-1552. This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago Review Podcast. Go see a play this week. Listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Interview Podcast. Our special guest today is Will Schutz, one of my favorite Chicago actors, currently featured in as Dr. Watson and other characters in City Let's Find production of Holmes and Watson. Will has an impressive body of work with major theater companies such as The Hypocrites, Defiant Theater, Next Theater, Straw Dogs, and Steep Theater Company. Will is that plump guy who always entertains us, but seldom gets the recognition he deserves. It's about time you learned about this fine actor. Hello, Will.
Oh, hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know, at City Lit, I think they return to their roots and doing plays that come out of literature. And I've seen you in a number of shows there. And I think Holmes and Watson is really a strong piece.
Yes, I agree. It's great to work with Don Bender again, who is my the home in this. This is four or five times I've worked with Don now, and we seem to have a fairly good rapport.
Yeah, the chemistry between you guys is almost perfect. And how does it feel to get, I guess you could say, Star Rebellion? It's basically a two-man show, even though there's the one lady has a part in Act One.
Yes, Megan Prinsby plays Irene Adler in The King of Bohemia, Scandal in Bohemia. Yeah. And does a wonderful job. It's a little unusual. I'm used to playing much smaller parts, but I after 27 years, it varies. You know, sometimes I play larger roles, sometimes I play multiple smaller roles. You know, sometimes I just walk across the stage and trip. You know.
Well, I've not seen that unless it was part of the act.
Oh well, obviously, yeah, for comic relief.
One of the things that I've always liked about your work is how adept you are on turning on a dime or leaving the stage, you know, changing a jacket, coming back on as a totally different character. One could be a comic buffoon, and the next character could be this emotionally wrought character. And it's just amazing watching an actor that can do that kind of stuff.
Oh, well, thank you.
Tell us how, again, let's go back. There are people who just can't play character roles. You know, they're either the leading man or they move furniture. You know what I mean? What does it take to do that? What kind of a mental state does it create?
Well, I kind of crazy. I don't I personally am one of those actors who I find that my ego usually gets in the way. So I try not to have much of an ego about the parts that I play, really. People talk about, you know, my character wouldn't do that. Well, it says right there in the script that they do. it's really just sort of getting out of your way and not having any inhibitions. And if you have to play a real SOB, enjoy it, because you're not hurting anybody. It's all pretend, you know. You're hurting the feelings of perhaps the other actor on stage, but you're actually not hurting them, you're hurting their character. So it's really just a matter of getting out of the way of what the playwright intended, and to play the character as honestly and as humanly as possible, and understanding with that there are no black and white characters, unless that's a stylistic choice. You know, everybody sort of shades of gray.
You seem to specialize in these way out characters, which I think is great casting, because, like you said, it takes someone who is comfortable with themselves and who can put ego aside to be able to play the buffoons, do pratfalls, get a pie in the face, or get humiliated on stage, whatever the part calls for.
Well, sure, revel in looking foolish. I mean, you know, you don't get to do that normally in life, so, you know, this is your big chance, is the way I look at it. And anybody who knows me or has worked with me has probably at some point or another heard my philosophy of rehearsing, which sometimes, depending on the director of the piece, and, you know, it's because it is a collaborative art between the actors and the director, as well as the design team, that my philosophy going into rehearsals really is, you can't come back if you've never been there. That is to say that you should go 100% in one direction, and if it doesn't work, you can always change direction, because it's a rehearsal and no tickets have been sold yet. It's much easier to cut back what you're doing than it is to try to get to some sort of emotional level that you haven't been to before.
Well, tell us about accents, because I'm going to ask you a little bit later on to do a few as far, but you have amazing talent for accents.
I basically, because my mentor in college at Nebraska, Dr. William R. Morgan, was my acting teacher. He also taught the dialect class. And I was trained with somebody who I don't know how much they're used in schools and universities anymore, and that was Jerry Blunt, who has written a couple of stage dialect books. Two or three of them.
Yes, I'm familiar. He's considered one of the deans of the science, right?
Yeah, and he's very much, you know, IPA, International Phonetic Alphabet. But I guess I'm trained by ear, because a lot of what Blunt did and the way Dr. Morgan taught us was to record foreign English speakers. That is, people who were from Russia or France, who knew English, and they would read a piece of text, and you would hear the diphthongs and the vowel and consonant changes that they were naturally using as they spoke their second language, which for them would be English. So, I have to, you know, give kudos to the dialect coach for Holmes and Watson, Martin Astro. I worked with him the last show that I did, which was at Sea, and he actually taught me a new English dialect, because Great Britain, like America, has a wealth of different dialects.
Wasn't that Yorkshire?
That was actually East Anglia.
Oh, East Anglia. That's different than Yorkshire, though.
It's that area, the marshland north of London, yeah. Which is East Anglia, is those are the folks who settled New England. So it's this weird, it's one of the few English dialects I've heard that doesn't have broad A substitution.
Okay, you're talking about the Night Heron.
Night Heron,
you're right.
Yeah.
You were terrific at that.
Oh, thank you. And these were, you know, the Cambridge Gardeners.
Well, can I put you on the spot? Can you give me a couple of lines of East Anglican?
Well, sure. Let me see here. That old garden cut across, off them rose bushes to it.
And you know what's great about that? As I understood it.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I think you're very good at. You know, those of us who are older critics, we are, one of the hang-ups most of us have is inarticulate actors, particularly a lot of the young kids. They mumble or they speak too fast. They don't enunciate enough. And you are so good at doing accents, enunciating, and speaking fast. You know, you get those parts where you have to do a little narration or you have to, you know, bridge a setup for the next scene and you're out there talking fast in character and in the accent, and we understand every word of it.
Oh, well, thank you.
That is a skill.
It's necessary. I mean, you know, Holmes and Watson is a perfect example of that because there is so much narration for things that if you just watch them would take 2 seconds. But I have to kind of whip through things fairly quickly, otherwise I'm holding up the actor on stage trying to actually physically do what I'm talking about. And it's a matter of timing, and also, you know, these particular things, I mean, every play really, in essence, tells a story. You know, it's that why is the playwright breaking the silence of the universe, to, you know, to have written the play. And this being Arthur Conan Doyle, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I guess I should say, and being based on actual literature, it gets a little thick sometimes, but also it's just for good storytelling purposes, it's more engaging if you change your rhythm. It's, you know, earning your pauses as well as the emotional content is sometimes, you know, if it's a heavier emotion, sometimes it's slower. You know, obviously, if you're talking about things that are very exciting, you're going to go much faster than you normally would if you're talking about something.
Yes. Let me ask you this. Your director for Holmes and Watson was Terry McCabe, who also adapted the piece.
Yes.
So how much in the rehearsal was it sort of a creative process to, you know, to get it down? I know he had an idea in mind and wrote a script, but did you have input, and you and Don, in terms of this didn't work, or as articulate as you are, the one phrase is just one phrase too many?
Well, certainly there was some of that, and mostly it was having to do with the redundancy.
Okay.
Because a lot of times the original author would be writing this during a cricket match, and he would forget. There are a lot of times when Holmes will describe something or set up a situation, and then he'll also describe it as he's doing it, and then after the fact, he'll tell you, he'll give you the same description of what he has just done. So that's three of the same thing.
Yeah, so part of that is editing, and part of that is you guys sensing that it's redundant, right?
Sure. And do they really need to know this? Couldn't we lose this because it's sort of indicated in another 2 pages?
Yeah, well, that's what made Holmes and Watson, to me, so enjoyable is you guys covered 2 short stories that were, you know, complicated, and you have to listen to them because that's the way Doyle wrote. But you guys made it so interesting. I mean, you painted the picture.
Well, good.
And both the words and, of course, by acting it out. And I thought, I thought Act 1 was your act, and I thought Act 2 was more of Don's act. It's just the way the plots fell.
Well, sure.
But, I mean, you going from Watson and into the Bohemian character.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little sample of maybe Watson saying something to somebody then all of a sudden becoming the Bohemian King?
I may have to skip around a little bit.
Okay.
Watson would say things like, for many years, he had approached the digital stalking all paragraphs concerning men and things, so that it was difficult to name a subject or a person on which he could not at once furnish information. In this case, I found her biography sandwiched in between that of a Hebrew rabbi and that of a staff commander who had written a monograph on the Bohemian fishes. And whereas the King of Bohemia would say something like, 5 attempts have been made, 2 burglars in my pay ransacked the house. Once we diverted her luggage when she traveled, 2 she has been waylaid. There has been no result.
Very good. Very good. And of course, let me add that if we were watching you on stage, your facial figures, the whole body language changes.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, you have to, so that the audience can tell who you're doing from one second to the next, it helps if you to give, I mean, the King of Bohemia, that sort of has a protruding upper lip. I think in the story he's described as having a hanging lip. And he stands up much straighter, stands with arms akimbo, and I've made a conscious choice never to have Watson with hands on hip. Just so, you know, if he ever does, he goes, oh, is he a king of Bohemia now? No, he's not. So it's all posturing and a lot of, like, the older characters I do. The old woman is much more hunched over. The old Styler in the second act, Styler the Elder, as he's called, is sort of shoulders up, like, you know, maybe he has some sort of spinal, like, calcium deficiency or something going on with, you know, if he's so old. But, yeah. And the King of Bohemia is honestly sort of an amalgamation of dialect. It was sort of odd. I in rehearsing this, because of the description that Sir Arthur gives of the King of Bohemia, it struck us in rehearsal that he's a bit like, if you know the old Mary Tyler Moore show, he's got that, you know, the ego that gets in the way of his intelligence. So
yes.
He's kind of like Ted Baxter. And historically, the King of Bohemia really wouldn't have been German. He would have been Austrian. It's that end of, you know, pre-World War.
That's right. He would have been Austrian. Or possibly Hungarian.
Yeah, pre-World War I. So it's sort of like he's the Bohemian king, but with not a lot of power.
Yeah, it's a Habsburg.
Yeah, kind of a figurehead. Yeah. It's the end of that line. And so for a while, because he's described as like Herculean Austrian, I was actually doing Arnold for a while. But after a while, Arnold Schwarzenegger has got such a rhythm to the way he speaks and such a definitive way of speaking that he's harder to understand. Besides the fact that before the King of Bohemia shows up, he's referred to as a German like 2-3 times. So you sort of set the audience up to hear a German dialect, and if you come out with an Austrian, which is different, I mean, a lot of people might not recognize that or know that, but as an actor, I would know it, and there's probably somebody out in the house who might know it. So I'm not doing a lot of the regular German substitution. I'm keeping it very clip. I'm doing more of an Austrian medial roles are like Betty and Buddy and that sort of thing, but I'm at the same time taking away from the German. I'm not doing that SPH substitution in words that start with SP or SP, you know, the oh my stars, spiel the milk, you know, I'm not doing that because although while it is funny, it's harder to understand, you know.
Like I said, that's the key as far as I'm concerned that I've noticed in your work over the past few years that I've been noticing you is how much you articulate and still carry off the accent. And there's only a few people who can do it. I think you're one of them.
Well, it's a matter of, you know, picking and choosing your sound substitution so that people know, oh, this guy is Irish or this guy is a Cockney or he's German. But still being understood.
One of the other things that stands out in the play is how well you and Don Bender, the chemistry on stage. He gets out of your way when you're doing your thing and you're out of his way. And that shows a lot of respect.
Yeah, I mean, Don's very good and has a really good sensibility. You know, whenever we feel like if we happen to take one half step too little on stage, we will always adjust so that we're not upstaging the other person, you know, that sort of thing. We're always very aware of you know, well, this is, you know, you and I will pay intense attention to you so that even if people do look at me, they'll see me focus on you and they'll go, well, what do you do?
And that becomes, you know, in that small stage at City Lit, that works rather well. You do notice that.
Oh, sure, yeah, and it all give and take.
Okay, but I see you guys getting along, and I'll tell you right now, when I saw the two names, I said, wow, you know, people who know Chicago theater, when they see the two of you in a play, that's almost a give and the go, you know?
Well, we hope so.
How's the play been going so far?
Good. It's early yet. You know, Chicago audiences, they're sort of an ebb and flow to them, or at least they're too speed. Just because, you know, there's so much out there that, you know, you can't, it's almost impossible to see everything. And you just have to sort of pick and choose.
Well, that's true. Even as a reviewer, you know, but that's why one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast is not only as a sort of an ode to the body of work that I've seen you do, but also to let Chicago audiences know that there is a tremendous talented group of actors out there who lay it on the stage, you know, every performance, and really do some marvelous work.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And honestly, I've made a conscious choice not to join the union. I have a day job, as does Don. You know, we do the 9-to-5 thing, or, you know, flex our hours a little bit, but 5 days a week we're doing a day job to keep a roof over our heads and, you know, pay electric bills and all that good stuff.
Well, I had Iris Lieberman on last week, and like she pointed out with Equity Actor, now here's a lady that's almost always working, and she said, when I'm working, I'm one of the 2% of Equity Actors who are working. The 1%, one of the top percent are all doing New York or, you know, Broadway, sure, Chicago stuff. So she was giving advice to young actors, you know, the old thing, don't quit your day job.
Yeah. Okay.
And it is really hard when you go full-time, because I understand with Equity they can do daytime rehearsals and things, so yeah, it would really conflict with a full-time gig, right?
Well, it does. There's a theater company in town who has tried to cast me on a couple of occasions, and I have to turn them down because they rehearse during the day. And honestly, I'm you know, to a certain extent, I'm in it for the insurance. You know, I have much better insurance through a day job than Actors Equity would offer me. Plus the fact, you know, I mean, Actors Equity has, because there are up to a billion Equity Actors and, you know, a finite number of parts every year in all over this country, that the unemployment rate for Equity is staggering.
But right now you get in Equity shows because you're not Equity, and they know that you're as good as anybody that they could hire for Equity.
For sure. And, you know, I had a great time. It was sort of like a mini Defiant reunion when I, about this time last year, I was doing Dario Fo's Accidental Death of an Anarchist. You know, Joe Faust was in it, Linda Gillum directed, and the original Krieger from Action Movie. Kirk Anderson was in, and Sean Sinisky. So, you know, I had a grand time.
Well, tell us a little about, now I know Defiant is gone, but some of the younger people who listen to this podcast might not know him. And I can tell you, I saw the last few shows at Defiant, and you talk about overachieving group. Wow. What you guys did was, it was so insane, it worked.
Yeah, it was kind of nuts. we're one of those groups that, there were those years when we were basically building sets out of other people's garbage, you know, dumpster diving and all that good stuff, and we never paid our actors, or rarely paid our actors. Most of the money went into the production budget, and although some of the stuff we pulled off was in the cheesiest and cheapest way possible, it worked to great comic effect.
It sure did. And you used to have a cast of thousands. I mean, 25, 30 actors was, sure, no big deal for you guys, right?
No. I think the largest cast that I remember was the second to the last show that we did was a stage adaptation of Pirates. And there were 31 people in that cast. And we had 2 boat units on stage that we moved around. It was, you know, that's the sort of thing. It was like nuts. But I played 5 characters in that, I believe.
Well, that's what is that, about normal for you in a
sometimes
Defiant show, right?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
But everybody played 2 or 3 characters, right?
Oh, sure,
yeah,
sure. I mean, there were the leads, like the major pirate captains were pretty much, you know, they got into their characters, and that was what they played throughout. I played 4 characters in, like, the first act or so, and once we got to the second act, I became Enchilada.
Well, so you're saying that a lot of the non-Equity theater companies either don't pay or pay very little. So You don't do this for the money necessarily. Tell us about that. I mean, we hear this, and I understand that. People say, why do I go to, 30 show? I think I went a string of 49 days once where I saw 54 plays. Wow. They say, you're crazy. And I go, why? It's what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, you really have to have a love for it in order to do this and not just give up the ghost. I'm sure lots of other actors do this. I'm not in it for fame and fortune, certainly. Fame would be, I guess, kind of nice, but you completely lose your privacy, and that I think that would really drive me nuts. I do it because I get to be other people, really. I get to explore, some of the darker sides of emotion and psychology, and we're all shades of gray. I mean, like that character A, the poor abuser, really. I'm sure he didn't kick every dog he saw, I mean, there are good things and bad things about even the nastiest of people. And they all have their motivations for doing the nasty and horrible things that they do. But they're also, at the same time, human.
Yes.
Human emotions and thoughts and all, the whole ball of wax.
All right. Let me ask you this now. It's at City Lit Theater.
Yeah.
It's Holmes and Watson. Mm-hmm. What days do you perform? Give us time for a little plug.
Okay. Well, this City Lit Theater there's a 99-seat theater on the second floor of the historic Edgewater Presbyterian Church, which is on the corner of Kenmore and Bryn Mawr, 1020 West Bryn Mawr. We are performing Friday and Saturday night at 8 p.m. at the curtain house, probably either around 7:30 or so. House usually opens at 22 or quarter to 8 on those nights. I should probably tell people, because of the neighborhood, there's a restaurant diagonally across the street. I'll give them a plug too.
Sure.
Franchise's,
okay.
Which does have valet parking, if you go and have dinner.
And you're only like a block or so from the Bryn Mawr Red Line.
Yeah, the Red Line, we're like a block and a half east of that. The Peterson bus will get you there. That Sheridan 151, I believe, runs right
by. And you do Sundays at 3.
Yeah, Sundays at 3. And tickets are available by calling the box office, which is 773-293-3682. That's 773-293-3682, or you can, I believe, go to www.citylit, that's CITYLIT, lit as literature, .org.
And you're running till what, June 4th, I believe?
June 4th, yeah.
Okay, what's coming up for you?
I have been, it's weird. I count myself blessed in the fact that sometimes I will go see people's shows, and I know, a lot of actors in town. And sometimes people will just walk up to me and say, will you come to my callback, or we're doing this, will you play this part? It's very nice. I wish that for every actor in the world, really. It's a great honor, really, for me, for my friends, to do that for me. I'm actually trying to maybe take the summer off, just to get my house in order. And do some things, maybe travel a little. But there's also, what do I have coming up? I have someone who has asked me, they have started their own theater company, and they have asked me to audition for, I believe they're doing, it might be a new adaptation of Tom Middleton's Jane. I also have a friend of mine at the Factory Theater who has written a script, and he would like me to read it. I believe he's working on his draft, right?
Oh, last question, because we're just about out of time.
Okay.
Have you done any musicals?
Musical is not my forte, but I have done a couple of them. In my youth, I did the father figure in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. When I was doing repertory theater, summer stock, basically, on Cape Cod, I played Gremio in Kiss the Case. And that's pretty much the extent of it. I've done, you know, two or three maybe, but not my forte really.
I could see you doing especially some of the comic parts.
Okay.
Some of the plays. Would you like to do one if the right role came up?
Perhaps. I don't really, you know, I guess I could carry a tune in a bucket, but I don't really consider myself a singer or dancer. You know, I can sing, and certainly I've sung on stage before. You know, there's the great, the Red Flag, or the huge revolutionary song, communist song that we all sung, Accidental Death of an Anarchist. That was always fun. That's, I think, the second version of that I've had to sing on stage. I can sing, and you know, if I have to, I can dance a little bit. Just as I said in my bio, I have been trained as a actor combatant, so I can.
So you're a sword fighter?
Yeah, you know, usually when the Society of American Flight Directors certifies you or tests your skill level, there's normally unarmed or hand-to-hand combat, rapier and the dagger fight. And then a third, sometimes even fourth weapon. My alternate weapons have in the past been like quarterstaff and broad vessel.
Because that always sometimes scares me. I know when you guys were Defiant, you did some amazing stage combat.
Yeah.
Were you one of the instructors in that, or?
They usually had somebody. I mean, I have on the slide sort of choreographed for smaller theater companies,
okay.
But it's not something I feel proficient enough, really. You know, and when I've been asked to choreograph, it's basically stepping in to make sure that it's safe.
Well, you know, I'm sure glad this has been terrific, and I think everyone now knows who you are, and I think they'll come see the show, and I think this is an appreciation for you guys that are in the trenches, the character actors in local theater.
Well, thank you very much.
I mean,
thank
I try and mention much. As many names as I can in shows, but,
sure.
You know, it's just the nature of the piece half the time. You know, you mention the stars, and then you might throw a little bone to the ensemble, but many times you guys are the ones that really make the play go.
Well, sure, and certainly, you know, a lot of that stuff, like Dr. Xylene, I mean, you know, was all about the exposition and making the plot move, which is why I made him such a cartoony German. Oddly enough, if I remember correctly, what xylene is a chemical compound that petrifies natural materials and melts them with plastic, because it was part that was all exposition, and its exposition is boring. You know?
Yeah, you showed that it can work in theater with someone who can enunciate and articulate it and hold the audience.
Well, thank you.
You certainly had to do that in Holmes and Watson, particularly in Act 1. Well, actually, both acts, as you set up all the stuff for Don to do in Act 2.
Yeah, and this is one of the things I really appreciate that Terry McCabe has done in his direction is I walked into this with Watson being such a recognizable literary figure. I don't want to denigrate what he had done, he was asked to do, and executed beautifully what he was asked to do, but I was kind of in this trying to undo the damage that Nigel Bruce had done in those old films. There's usually, I mean, Watson is the chronicler of the story. There's a tendency sometimes in, especially in the film version, but to make Sherlock Holmes appear more intelligent by dumbing down Watson.
Yes.
And I think the opposite is actually true. If you find that Watson is of above average intelligence, and he is an army, and he is a doctor, that the things that he misses, because he's the eyes of the audience, who are also, you have to give them credit for being intelligent, it's the things that they miss, that he misses, that Holmes picks up on, that makes him that much more brilliant. It's like, oh, wow.
Yeah. I think you conveyed that, and what I think the ultimate thing in the last few seconds we have here is that I think you and Don have sort of put a stamp and a trademark, and I just hope that Terry McCabe and those guys start doing some of the other short stories. It's like a little cottage industry.
Time will tell.
But I think you guys, you wouldn't mind playing it again, would you?
No.
Yeah, I think if this show does as well as we hope it will, I think that will happen.
I hope.
Let's hope so, because You guys are a marvelous talent, and it just takes particular people to be able to do, you know, Holmes and Watson stories with a few characters. You don't need a cast of thousands to do these.
No, no, you don't.
You know, I mean, you might have added one more, but you could easily do most of them with four or five characters.
Yeah.
So that speaks a lot. Well, thank you so much for the interview.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the you're asking me.
Well, you know, it's time we give some recognition to the people that are the bedrock of local Chicago theater, and I definitely think you are one of those.
Well, thank you very much.
And I was impressed with your work, and we'll try and do what we can to get the audiences to come out and see it.
Well, I hope so.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this essential episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote has to deal with suspicion. Comes from the Comedy of Errors, Act 3, Scene 1. There is something in the wind. Well, we can't thank you enough for listening to this podcast. Remember, every Monday we have a new episode ready for your ears. Until then, I'm Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.